the field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train. Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Good afternoon once again, everybody, and welcome to our Wednesday edition of Trainer Talk, all presented by Bullet Train. Frankel's three-quarter brother standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station here in Midway, Kentucky. This is the show that trainers listen to, and we welcome everybody tuning in coast to coast on Sirius 93 XM 209 Internet Smartphone Channel 961. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, ready to roll with a couple of special guests here tonight, as always. And JT, going to be a fun show. Today's show featuring a pair of trainers who, at this point, are on the Derby trail. And although they may not have the same name recognition of Mott, Pletcher, Baffert, Zito, it's important to keep in mind that at one point in their careers, they didn't have that name recognition either.
Well, that's true. We heard from Bill Mott on one of our trainer talk shows that he couldn't even get stalls at Centennial Park in Colorado. So everybody has to start somewhere. And these guys are both journeyman trainers. They're accomplished. They've won lots of races and couldn't be happier that both of them are on the Derby trail. It's got to be exciting for them. And it's exciting for the fans as well.
Well, let's get right to it. Jeff Greenhill is our first guest of the evening. He will be here right up until 6:30 Eastern time. And then he'll be followed by Keith DeSormo in the second half of the show. Jeff, certainly no stranger to the winner's circle. The 55-year-old native of Sheffield, Alabama, has racked up 334 career victories, and his runners have earned more than $5.1 million in purses. And guess what? He's off to one heck of a start here in 2013. How about this batting average? He's won 9 of 27 starts so far this year. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Happy to have you with us tonight, and thanks so much for taking the time.
No problem.
Well, look, we'll go back to the beginning. We'll get to your Derby horse, Mac the Man, here throughout the show, but we want to go back to the beginning because this show, as I mentioned to you earlier this afternoon, much more about you and your background and how you got started. You're a graduate of Auburn University with a degree. Excuse me?
I said War Eagle.
War Eagle.
Now, so I guess I can take that to mean you don't bleed blue, even though you live in Kentucky.
No, I'm transplanted.
Well, you graduated with a degree in chemical engineering, and I just have to ask, what on earth possesses a chemical engineer to want to get up at the crack of dawn 365 days a year and make a living as a horse trainer?
Well, the easy answer is there's no winner's circle in chemical engineering. But I was always sort of an oddball in chemical engineering. I didn't really have the personality to be a chemical engineer. But my dad was a school teacher. My mom was a Sears and Roebuck sales lady. And so when I graduated from high school, I essentially asked, what profession makes money? And they said engineering. And I said, which engineer makes the most money? And they said chemical engineering. And I said, sign me up. If they'd have said home economics, I would have said, give me an apron. So,
smart
early
man.
On, my goal was to get off to a running start on the financial side.
So how did it all start for you in terms of your interest in horses? How far does that go back?
You know, I don't know. I truthfully can't answer that because no one in my family has this obsession. I think that my granddad did race mules, but I guess that might be where I get it from because for whatever reason, early in my life, I was absolutely intrigued by horses. As a matter of fact, the folks who know said my first word was dad or daddy, and my second word was horse, and I worked mom in shortly thereafter. So I truthfully can't answer what the obsession is, but I love horses. I just do.
Were you raised around them? Where are
no.
you from? No.
No, my parents didn't have the land for horses. We actually didn't have the money for horses. And so once I graduated my degree in chemical engineering, I quickly acquired more than I needed. But they were quarter horses. And I team roped for a while and, you know, played around with reining horses and cutting horses. But it became pretty obvious. It became pretty obvious quickly that if I was going to actually make a living in horses, I would have to do something more than run for ribbons and jackpots. And that's the way I became attracted to horse racing, because they have that parimutuel pool that kind of drives the industry. And you can, if you're lucky and work hard, actually make a living in it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, growing up in Alabama, not exactly a horse racing mecca, to see you in the position that you're in today and to see the success you've had throughout your career is amazing, Jeff. But what's the first horse race that you remember attending in person?
Well, it was not until briefly before I started training horses. I grew up down in Alabama. Truthfully, I lived in the northwest corner, and if I had wanted a racing form, I would have had to drive 2.5 hours to Birmingham. And so that was before internet and all the wonderful resources we have now. But I guess the first races I ever went to were in Birmingham when they were running there. As a matter of fact, I saw Lost Code break his maiden, and then he went on to win the Hoop Junior Stakes in the Alabama Derby, and then went on to win over $3 million, I think, as a racehorse. So the first live race I saw was in Birmingham, Alabama.
That track is closed now. Did you go to the races there frequently, or were you just a casual fan?
Nope. Went down there a couple of times as a casual fan. And I think I went down there for a Breeders' Cup simulcast once, and then happened to be in town on a business trip the night that a Lost Code broke his maiden.
Jeff Greenhill, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, all presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Jeff, you graduate in 1979 from Auburn, that degree in chemical engineering. You didn't work in the business right away. You spent some time, as you mentioned, in your profession working in that field. What led you to make the decision to start getting involved with horses and training them?
Well, as I said, I had quarter horses on the side, and but I'd get the blood horse, and I would read it. I would take my lunch hours and just go out the parking lot and eat a sandwich and read the blood horse cover to cover. And then I read about this thing called pin hooking. And so I got my business in the thoroughbred in by going to Keeneland and buying weanlings, taking them back to my farm in Alabama, fitting them for a sale, and then bringing them back up and selling them as yearlings. And I did pretty well at that, but it still wasn't an everyday involvement with horses. And so finally, I just kept thinking about being a horse trainer. And I talked to a lot of people. I talked to a lot of trainers. I talked to some people in the pin hooking business, and when they didn't laugh at me out loud, I thought, you know, maybe this is not an undoable dream, the impossible dream. And so I spoke with my wife, Sherry, about it and said, you know, I really think I'd like to try my hand at training racehorses. And then kind of fortuitously, TVA offered an early retirement program. And the purpose, of course, was to get some of the older heads out of there and cut on salaries. But they had to offer it to everybody. And so at 38 years old, I took an early retirement package. And we moved up here and I started walking hots for D-Wayne Lucas. My first job was a hot walker for D-Wayne Lucas. And then I groomed for Peter Vestal and Donald Abib. And after about 2.5 years of that, I got my trainer's license. And I've been waking up at 4 o'clock every morning, 7 days a week since.
Well, and you mentioned your wife, Sherry. Talk about her involvement. I know she's very, very supportive, obviously, of everything that you've done. She's involved in the business. Talk about her and what she's meant to you and to your operation.
Well, she has been, you know, she's got a job that obviously helps with me being able to have health insurance and that sort of thing. And she's got a really good job. And she has really embraced what I'm doing. I started listing her as an owner early on and let her design her own silks. And you would be amazed how much difference that made. When she got to see the horses run in the silks that she designed. But she's been a big support and was willing to pull up roots and move several states away and re-begin her profession, and then it was supporting a hot walker there for a while.
She must really love you.
I told somebody that the last year I worked as a chemical engineer, I think I paid taxes on income of $115,000. My first year on the track, I paid taxes on income of $7,500.
There you go. Sums it up pretty well.
Jeff, talk about that first job that you had on the racetrack. You mentioned being a hot walker. Talk about that experience and going to the track the first time.
I walked on the track and talked to Dallas Stewart, who was the assistant for D-Wayne Lucas, and he gave me a job, told me to show up the next day, and I would be a hot walker. I didn't know what a hot walker did, so I showed up in tight roper boots, and then ended up walking, I don't know, half a dozen horses, 45 minutes each. And I ended up losing several pounds and a couple of toenails. But I did find some comfortable footwear after that. And, you know, that was when he had Tabasco Cat. And, I mean, it was a dream come true. I'd gone from watching the Derby on TV, watching Wayne Lucas win several Breeders' Cup races, to being in a shed row and leading these million-dollar horses around. And, I mean, it was I'd gone from managing about 60 people to leading 6 horses, but I felt more compelled to do a better job in the shed row, actually, than I did at the other, because those folks could simply take care of themselves without me. But horses need you to take care of them. And, you know, that comes sometimes as a big responsibility, but it sure is fulfilling.
Well, that's a great story. And now you can number yourself with Todd Pletcher and Mark Hennig and Dallas Stewart and all the other former D-Wayne Lucas employees that have done well.
With the one exception that they were assistant trainers and I was a hot walker. So when I left the stable, D-Wayne didn't feel compelled to send several clients and horses with me.
Well, if you win the Derby, maybe he'll send you something.
Well, I'll tell you what, it was a pleasure working around him, because he was the consummate horseman and he was there every morning early, just like we were. And I'd always respected him, but after I worked for him, I respected him even more.
Are there things that you learned when you were working for Wayne? That we've heard this from a lot of you know, the Dallas Stewarts of the world, Kieran, a lot of his disciples, so to speak. Have you learned, taken some things that you learned with him and incorporated them into your operation today, Jeff?
Well, if I ever had 100 horses, I think I could. But, you know, I saw how to manage a whole lot of horses efficiently. Now, I don't have those kind of numbers, but it was a well-run machine. Everybody knew their responsibility. Everybody came in you got it done. I mean, they were going to the track sometimes six horses at a time. I don't obviously have that quantity, and but I saw just how professionally and how detail oriented he was in managing so many horses. And if I ever aspired to have that many horses, things I learned from him, I could very well take on. Plus the fact that his barn, his shed rows were immaculate, and the feeding program. I think I have adopted some of the things in his feeding program that have helped me. But, you know, sometimes it matters what kind of stock you're feeding.
Yeah, no doubt.
I would like to get a little better stock. But we have, over the course of the last couple of years, improved our stock.
All right, so you go from walking hots for Dwayne Lucas, and then you went and became a groom for Donny Habib, is that right?
Well, Peter Vestal first.
Peter Vestal, okay, then Donny.
And if you remember, Pete, back in the day, was a premier trainer. He trained Grey Cashmere and Eyed, and just, I think he won maybe 50, 60 stake races and multiple stake races. And, I hot walked, and then I groomed for Peter Vestal. And then when they headed to Oaklawn in the winter, my family, you know, being here with Sherry did not allow me to ship with them. And so then I went to work for Donny Habib, and I learned a lot from Donny too.
Well, that's, a situation where you came into the business a little later, and you already had your wife and everything going on. It's a lot easier when you break in when you're young, you know. It's like being a minor league pitcher when you're in your 30s. It's a tougher row to hoe for those guys than it is for a young person that can just pick up and go.
Oh, I agree 100%. I didn't saddle my first horse till I was 41. And but, you know, learning some of the things I learned in the corporate world didn't hurt either. I told someone if I'd have known about this game in high school, I'd be living in a tack room right now. But I, in some ways, I do wish that I would have had the ability to be introduced much earlier, because it has been an uphill climb to, you know, your first horse till you're 41 and not really have any connections in the business, and then trying to build a business by getting people involved that really don't know you. But we've been really lucky in being able to put together syndications, and the internet has been a wonderful help. We've got a website, and then here's a 7-year-old guy that's got a Twitter account and a Facebook page. But all of that helps.
Jeff, speaking of being 41 when you saddle your first horse, obviously that decision to go out on your own probably wasn't made lightly. Talk about making that decision and what led to that call to go out on your own.
Well, it was what I got in the business to do. And so when I went out on my own, I told Sherry, you know, if we can win 4 races this first year, we probably won't starve. But we ended up winning 11 and having a pretty good year. And then another thing I told her was, you know, Keeneland is the Mecca. So I'm ready for it to take 6 years for us to win our first race at Keeneland. And then the first horse I saddled at Keeneland won by 15. And we didn't know exactly how to act, so we just acted like we were from Alabama. We jumped up and down and hollered.
That's allowed. It's okay.
Yeah.
That's great. Jeff Greenhill, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, all presented by Bullet Train. So fast forward here, Jeff, you get to the point now where you're starting to amass quite a few winners, you're starting to get the purse earnings rolling. Who were some of the horses that really helped launch your career?
Oh, without a doubt. Well, that horse that won at Keeneland by 15 was an marathon starter horse named Isaac's my man. And I remember when we ran him at Keeneland going a mile and 5/8. It was the first time he ever tried a marathon distance. And the little comment in the racing form was, another one who will be gasping for air at the wire. And he won by 15, and he just turned out to be a natural marathon starter horse. And he ended up winning 5 in a row at Turfway. As a matter of fact, I got a video of Willie Martinez rubbing him on his neck at the 16th pole. He was winning so easy going a mile and 5/8 at Turfway. And then about the fourth horse I ever trained was a filly named Snappy Little Tune. And Snappy Little Tune, just, man, she was a come-from-behind sprinter. She would be 15 out of it up backside and just blow by him in the turn. She ended up winning about almost $400,000 at the races. And I think she won 13 times. And I said, this is the fourth horse I've ever trained. This is the easiest game in the world. I'm going to be rich and famous. And that's sometimes getting one that good that early can be a little bit of a curse, because I thought it was me, but guess what? It's the horse. And so Snappy Little Tune got our name out there. And along the way, you know, we've just had some hard-knocking allowance-type horses up until last year. I mean, we've had horses like T.K.'s Turn, who won 6 in a row at River Downs. We've had Cam the Man, who broke his maiden first time and won several allowance races at Prescott Vance. At Shake Your Groove Thing, who was another marathon starter horse that has made over 200,000. Another horse that kind of put me on the map was a horse named El Bamba, who won his 100th start at Turfway Park. And there was a little piece in the Cincinnati news about him. And so all of that stuff kind of helps. And then last year we had Ain't She a Saint, who ended up being the Indiana Horse of the Year. And then this year we've got Silver Tongued and Mac Man. And hopefully, you know, just a couple of years ago I started amassing enough funds to go to Keeneland and buy some, you know, horses that had a shot. I wouldn't pay him $750,000. I wouldn't even pay him $75,000. But we were buying $20,000 horses that had a chance. They were nice enough looking individuals. They looked like athletes, and they've turned out to be runners for the most part. And I think that's the way you do it when you're in my position.
Well, Jeff, believe it or not, we're down to the final 4 minutes here before we have to get to the break at the bottom of the hour. But do have to talk about Mac the Man and being on the Derby trail with him. First of all, the man, my man, where does that come from in all the horse names?
Mac the Man. I mentioned a horse I named called Cam the Man. Cam the Man is Mac the Man's older brother. I really, really like that horse. And so I went to Keeneland specifically to try and buy his younger half-brother, which was this horse, the El Corridor Colt. I bought him, and so when we were trying to decide what to name him, I said, well, Cam, spelled backwards, is Mac. So Mac the Man got his name from his older brother, who was Cam the Man, just spelled Cam backwards, you get Mac.
That's fantastic. That's only a chemical engineer would think of something like that.
I don't know about that. Now, it may have been after a couple of months. I'm not sure.
That's pretty clever.
Jeff, in about a minute and a half or so, sum up what this is like for you at this point, starting to go down the road to the Kentucky Derby.
Well, I'm just taking it one day at a time, seriously, because I don't know what kind of horse he is. I don't know what he's run against. I just know he hadn't done a whole lot wrong. And so I'm trying my best to be realistic, keep expectations subdued, and my dad raised me to kind of, my motto has always been under promise and over deliver. So I'm not a kind of guy that gets real excited about a horse and says, how are they going to beat this horse today? Or they can't beat me, or make sure you bet my horse, or anything like that. I just take it a day at a time, put them in, and hope they run well.
One final question before we let you go, Jeff. Mac the Man, owned by your wife, Sherry. More pressure or less pressure when saddling one owned by your wife?
Well, actually, this horse has some partners, and we changed the owner line to do that. But Sherry is, I've told her in the past, I don't tell you how to do your job. And I think you can probably figure out the second part of that.
I guess you got to sleep with one eye open, huh?
There you go. But, hey, they're running in her stall. So that makes it all good.
Well, Jeff, we can't thank you enough for being our guest here on Trainer Talk, and I know that the HRN Nation has enjoyed this interview with you. Look forward to seeing you up at Turfway for the Spiral. We'll be there for the coverage, and can't wait to catch up with you again.
All right, anytime, guys.
All right,
thanks
all the
so
best.
Much.
Thanks, Jeff. All right, Jeff Greenhill, our special guest here on the first half of the show. Fun guy.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, very really smart, good. Very intelligent, and did it the hard way.
Yeah, I really enjoy these shows. I do say so myself.
Good story there. We're going to hear a great story coming up in the second half of the show. Another person on the Derby trail with a big long shot. That's Keith DeSormo, the brother of Hall of Fame rider Kent DeSormo.
There you go.
All right, it's coming up next on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, and it's all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station.
Presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train. It's time to get on board.
Group-winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at two with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a Group 1. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Montjoux and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky, for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
The Wizards Betting Window is now new and improved. Available exclusively at DRF.com, the Wizards Betting Window takes the work out of wagering by giving you just the Wizards' best plays and strongest opinions for wagering recommendations at top tracks around the country. Along with win and plays, the Betting Window includes pick threes, pick fours, and pick sixes, and 10-cent superfectas wherever possible. Both longtime horse players and racing newcomers can benefit from using the Betting Window. It's like no other handicapping sheet in the market. Only the Wizards Betting Window offers real-time changes to reflect late scratches, changing track and weather conditions, late equipment changes, and more. Just download the Betting Window while you do your handicapping in advance and then receive an updated final edition 30 to 60 minutes before the first race post time. The Betting Window final edition will be delivered right to your inbox so you can receive it anywhere you wager. Use the Wizard's best wagering strategies to help maximize your returns. Visit drf.com/wizbw to try the Wizard's Betting Window today. That's drf.com/wizbw.
You can be a better bettor just by knowing how a horse is working.
For the first time ever, RacingWithBruno.com's reports are available straight from the source.
Racing with Bruno's With the Works takes you behind the past performances into the morning routines that matter most.
With over 20 years of experience, our team of analysts specialize in first-time starters and layoff horses, as well as full-card workout reports and selections.
Go to RacingWithBruno.com.
Now with the works.
HRRN is your exclusive radio home for the 2013 Kentucky Derby. Join our Eclipse award-winning broadcast team as we take you along the road to the Kentucky Derby with live coverage of every major Derby prep race. And tune in Derby Week for over 20 hours of coverage live from Churchill Downs. Go to horseracingradio.net for a full schedule of races. It's the 139th Run for the Roses, only on HRRN.
Hi, this is Calvin Burrow. You're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network, the show that trainers listen to. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, our producer Lee Della Pina, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. A fun interview with Jeff Greenhill in the first half of the show, and now really looking forward to visiting with Keith DeSormo, somebody who has amassed more than 432 victories, actually exactly 432 victories, more than $9 million in earnings in a training career which began in 1991, the self-proclaimed Cajun Dorochenko. And he is with us now here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Keith, thanks so much for being here. Keith. Do we have you?
Yeah, I can hear you in the background, but it's a very not the best connection.
Okay, can we hear you right? Can you hear us now?
I heard some laughing there, but I didn't quite get what you were saying.
Okay. Well, no, I introduced you as the self-proclaimed Cajun Dorochenko, as you said after the Risen Star upset.
Hey, man, that was supposed to be a little funny quote, but it wasn't supposed to reach the papers or this radio. I don't know how that happened, but hopefully that's just good-hearted humor there.
Yeah.
I think so. I think Gennady would take it the right way.
Yeah.
Well, look, I mentioned the success you've had, 432 victories, more than $9 million in earnings. Your career began in 1991. What a tremendous ride.
You think? I'm going to honestly tell you that I've never looked at my lifetime stats. So it's $9 million and 422 victories.
Yeah,
I guess that's nice, but dang, it's taken 20 years.
Well, that's still not bad.
It's taken 20 years to get a horse at this level. Man, I hope it doesn't take another 20 years to get here again.
Well, sometimes they come in bunches.
Yeah, we'll hope for that.
Yeah, maybe you've opened the floodgates. I know you've certainly struck a few nerves, so to speak.
Yeah, let's hope it continues.
Yeah, we'll talk about that race for a minute because it is such an incredible performance and such a huge upset, 135-1. If I'm not mistaken, when you were in the winner's circle, you asked the photographer to kind of flip things around so you could catch the tote board in the background?
Yeah, I wish we would have followed through on that. I thought it would have made a hell of a picture for us to turn our backs to the tote board and take a picture of us with that $274 payoff in the picture. That sounds like a good keepsake.
Yeah.
But as far as the race is concerned, it was one of those rare occasions when everything comes together to as planned. The horse, like I've told everyone else, that the three previous route races, one at Santa Anita, one at Delta Downs, and the one at Fairgrounds, all came with very troubled trips. He basically ran off with my brother in the LeCompte. He was sent too fast in the Jean Lafitte, and he was pinned down on the inside and became very aggressive in his first race around two turns against Cold West at Santa Anita. So he had serious trouble every race. So we concentrated our efforts in the training previous to the Risen Star to try to get this horse to relax. James did a great job with him. It was nice having a home, basically a hometown jockey that spent some time with the horse. And it culminated in a very relaxed effort. It was what we trained him for. Now, training or not, I think also what got the horse to have a different state of mind as far as for aggressiveness is concerned is the fact that he came, that the LeCompte was a route race, and previous to the LeCompte he had run in two sprints. So just the fact that he was coming out of a route race helped the horse accept that he didn't need to go as fast the first part of the race. So everything came together and voila, 135-1.
It sounded like you had a lot of confidence going in. I mean, as much confidence as you can have in a horse that's going to be 135-1.
Yeah, that's the key word. As much confidence as you can have. But just like anyone else, I'm looking at the form. I do put some value in buyer speed figures. I think they're a great barometer. And that barometer said there's no way he's ever going to run as fast as it will take to win this grade two. And in the form, it does show that he's losing ground in the stretch. So how in the world is he going to gain ground when we're going a 16th of a mile further? So according to the form, he should have been 135-1. But according to me as a horseman and getting to see the horse every day, his confirmation, his soundness, his state of mind, his air of class, his pedigree, all of that tells me he should get a distance. So, but I have an advantage. I spend a day with him every day. So, yes, I had a degree of confidence. But what everybody else gets to look at is the form, and I agreed with their estimation. He should have been 101.
Well, Keith, when I called you yesterday to ask you to join us here on the show, you said something which really caught my attention. I said, you know, by the time you get to the Kentucky Derby, you'll be an old pro at doing these interviews and you'll be used to it by then. And you said, you know, everybody's calling me and assuming that we're going to the Kentucky Derby and there's a lot to be done between now and then. You've kind of kept things in perspective.
Of course. I think that's the right thing to do. And you know, and I'm not just saying that because it is supposedly the right thing to do as a horseman. Those are the facts. We won a race at 100-1, but he's got to duplicate that effort or something relatively close in the Louisiana Derby before we consider running in the Kentucky Derby. We all want to be in the Kentucky Derby. It's a great celebration of our sport. It's a lot of money. It's where all of your peers are concentrated for the first Saturday in May. So, yeah, we all want to be there. But if it's not right by the horse, if he doesn't show that he belongs, I don't think he will go. Plus, the facts say that there's a lot of other opportunities as far as money is concerned around the country that are not in Kentucky. So we try to keep all those perspectives in mind.
Well, that DeSormo name is etched in Derby history because of your brother, Kent, a three-time winner, Hall of Fame rider, three-time winner of the Kentucky Derby. Were you at Churchill Downs when Kent won those three Derbies?
You know, I was there for Big Brown. That was the only one. I was not there for Real Quiet, and I was not there for Fupeg. Was at Lone Star Park in those days. So I did catch one of them, yeah, and I caught both of the Triple Crown attempts with Real Quiet and Big Brown. So, yeah, it was exciting.
Well, Keith, we mentioned Kent's name, but there are other siblings involved in your family. You're the oldest of six, if I'm not mistaken. You grew up in Maurice, Louisiana, which has a population of, what, 967, according to a 2011 census. How on earth are our two brothers coming out of that area so successful in the sport of horse racing? Take us back to the beginning.
Well, you know, first of all, Maurice's population is not up there because Maurice is the center of maybe a farming community. Mm-hmm. Most people live in the rural areas, which are immediately out of the city limits of Maurice. So Maurice is by no stretch of the imagination a big town, but 900 seems a little small. But a rural farming community where horse racing is kind of etched in, as a part of our culture. So we grew up in that kind of in those surroundings. Of course, we were also involved in the typical sports-minded people like in the rest of the country, but we had the extra, I guess, I'll call it an advantage of being involved in the horse culture. So it was in no comparison to the level of racing that you would be privy to, let's say, if you lived in Louisville, in the outskirts of Louisville, but it was bush track racing on Sundays. It was free for all, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, those places in Louisiana like that have developed a lot of great horsemen and great riders. Did you start out as a rider, or were you inclined to do other things with the horses?
No, I never did ride. I did exercise my own horses most of my career as a trainer, but I never had the size or the wherewithal. I'll keep it kind to be a jockey. Those guys have nerves of steel and bravery at a young age. There was no way I was getting on an 1,100-pound horse going 40 miles an hour at 13 years old. No way. But Kent had that kind of mentality. He was all go and no fear at a young age. That's why he's been so successful. That wasn't part of my my MO. I was more into typical sports and of course horses, but not in a racehorse sense.
Hey Keith, talk about that relationship with Brother Kent and watching him come up and have so much success from an early age and go on to become a Hall of Famer. Talk about that relationship that you have with him and watching his career develop and unfold.
Well, first of all, it fills me with pride that my brother could be so successful in a career that he's chosen, and he's good and as one of the best to ever sit on a horse, and that's a matter of pride. But as far as I've always known that the area of the game that he's in as a rider, his skills or his success is mainly dependent on his athletic prowess, his skills, his quick thinking ability. Where as far as a trainer, your success is probably more dependent on your connections and your marketing. So it's more, trainers are more at a business end of the game, and riders is more depending on athletic ability. So I never had to compare our two careers. So it was always easy just to sit there as a brother and be proud and supportive. So that's how I always looked at our relationship as far as in the racehorse game.
So when you first got started in the business, who did you work for? How did you get going?
I first started on the racetrack during the summer of my second year of college. I graduated from Louisiana Tech in Ruston, Louisiana. So the second year, I was obviously starting to become interested in a career on the racetrack, and I was exercising horses on the farm, and I decided to give that summer a go in Maryland, where Kent was based, as an apprentice. So my first job on the track was with a trainer named Tommy Cavanis. I don't know if you guys go that far back. It was about in 87.
Okay.
86, 87. I worked the summer there with Tommy Cavanis. Came back to Louisiana, finished my college degree, and then I went back to Maryland and was an assistant trainer for Charlie Hadry. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with him. He trained Private Terms, was the Derby favorite, I think, in 86, and got beat by Winning Colors. So I worked for Charlie a couple of years and then went out on my own when Kent left Maryland. I never wanted that to be subconsciously when I started out, I didn't want Kent's success to be the reason for my success. So I didn't take out my trainer's license until Kent left Maryland. And about a year after that, I cranked it up and been fighting the game ever since.
did Kent ride many of your horses in the early days when you were just getting started?
No, because Kent hauled off to California.
Yep.
After he won that Apprentice Eclipse Award. I think he stayed in Maryland 1 year, and then he went out to California, and of course he stayed in California, I think, from 92 to 2009, so he was out there for almost 20 years. So in the early part of my career, we didn't get together at all.
Keith DeSarmo, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Keith, talk about some of the horses that helped to really kickstart your career as you were getting things going.
Well, the first horse that comes to mind is a horse called French Assault. I bought for a good friend and client of mine named Adam Ritchie out of Dallas, Texas. We went to the Breeders' Cup Juvenile in 2001. So, and we ran sixth. We got a beat ahead by the favorite for fifth. It would have been nice to say that my first Breeders' Cup starter got a check, but he didn't. He ran sixth to Officer. And that was a hell of a field. Sarlin was in there. It was won by Johannesburg. And I think Came Home might have been in there. I don't recall. Johannesburg and Officer come to mind, and Sarlin right offhand. So that was my first Breeders' Cup experience. That was my first horse at that level. And that was 10 years ago. And, you know, there's been several in between. Gangbuster also got me back to the Breeders' Cup in 2009 or 10. We went to the Breeders' Cup Marathon and ran fourth, so we got a check there. And those were my only two Breeders' Cup starters. There have been several stakes winners in between and several names I can mention, but French Assault is the first horse that got a taste for me at the top level.
When you're training horses, a lot of times you do a great job with a horse that's maybe not so famous. Who did you do your best work with that people may not, a horse they may not know about, but you really did some good work with?
Oh, goodness, I'll have to think about that one because, you know, most of my career, I do buy young horses every year because that's where the dream comes from. But to make a business work as far as the level of business that I'm usually located, we have to claim. So claiming horses are the best way to generate income for owners that may not have the resources to pay bills for 6-7 months until that young horse is ready to run. So when you say obscure or maybe unknown horses that we have had and did work on, it would have to be a claimer. Oh, goodness, who comes to mind? I claimed a horse called Kirby B that we won 7 in a row with. He was stakes placed. Man, that question caught me by surprise.
All right, well, that Kirby B sounds like a good one.
We did great work with Gangbuster, who was a 20,000. You know, that's what I call great work. We buy these horses. French Assault was a $20,000 yearling. Gangbuster was also a $20,000 yearling. Ended up making over $300,000. Took us to the Breeders' Cup. If I got to thinking about it, there would be several horses that are close to my heart, but that question really caught me by surprise.
Well, that's a tribute to your eye and to be able to buy those horses inexpensively and have them turn out so well. That's a good thing. That's what I was kind of looking at, you know, just something that a lot of trainers, you know, get the cream of the crop, but I know you're a guy that works hard every day and tries to find those horses that people can actually have some fun and make money with. And that's sometimes a lot more difficult than, having an unlimited bank account.
Well, it requires a little different way of thinking for sure. Difficult. The game is difficult at any level. But my MO as a purchaser of young horses with a chance to make it at the top level has always been, I don't have the funds, so I have to really pick the best of what the top people may not want. So, and believe me, I'm not saying that I'm at a disadvantage, because when I leave the sales with whatever I purchase at any price, I feel like I can develop it into a top horse. So it's fun.
Yeah, it's like being a catfish. You're kind of a bottom feeder, but you find those diamonds in the rough. You know, you find the ones that.
Are you comparing me to a catfish?
Yeah, Keith, I didn't know where that was going either. So,
well,
I take offense to that.
No, don't take offense, because I've said that about myself. I mean, my stable was a lot like yours in that I always had I didn't have a lot of rich clients, and we had to, you know, make do with whatever it was we got. So.
Well, you know, like I said, I'm not complaining. I'm very grateful and blessed to have the owners that I do, and just I feel very, I say the word grateful again, just for those guys that give me the opportunity to take them to the top.
Keith, after you upset the Risen Star, Matt Bryan, the owner of I've Struck a Nerve, had a quote where he said, "Keith is truly one of the great horsemen in the country." Talk about that relationship that you now have with Matt and how that all came about and what we can look forward to here in the future.
Well, Matt, we hit it off as soon as we met. You kind of just know someone that you're compatible with as soon as you meet them. Matt conducts his business in the same way that I feel like I conduct mine, with honesty and integrity, and we just hit it off right off the bat, and that trust and level of friendship between us two has shown in our success as a racing stable, you know, with winners right off the bat, and so I think that says it all. We're just very compatible on a personal level, and that shows off in our success on the racetrack.
One of the things that I've always enjoyed about you is your attitude and how every morning you're smiling, you're enjoying what you do. You know, a lot of trainers sometimes get down in the dumps when they're not winning a bunch of races or whatever. And you're the same whether you won three the day before or you had a horse run down the track. You always are out there smiling and having a good time. What do you attribute that quality to?
I don't know, man. You don't. You must not know my counterparts on the racetrack. Usually, they're constantly on my tail for not making a gesture until 8 o'clock. you're right. But after 8 o'clock, I've become pretty affable. But before 8, I'm pretty stern. So you got to wake up before 8 if you want to see the other side of me. But you know. The racetrack is a grind, man. You have to, if you wake up every day thinking that your life is a grind, then you probably won't be the most personable dude in the world. I try to wake up every day and be thankful that I get to live this pretty cool life as a horse trainer, and hopefully it shows in my personality.
Keith, after you won the Risen Star, you went to one of our favorite places in all of New Orleans, Brightson's, to celebrate. And we're huge fans. Neil Pessin turned us on to Brightson's a few years ago, and I'm sure that was a good time afterwards.
Yeah, you know, I gave up. You know, it's Lenten season in the Catholic Church right now, the 6 weeks before Easter, where you choose to give up something. And I give up alcohol almost every year, so the celebration on my part didn't include alcohol, but it was still pretty much fun. We got together and talked about the possible future with the horse, and had some laughs and kept it real simple. You know, we had a nice dinner and turned in. So it was simple, but how could you ask for anything better?
Just cashing a $20 win bet. That's a
oh yeah. It's never enough. It's never enough. Those kind of prices, it's never enough.
Talking with Keith DeSormo here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It's all presented by Bullet Train. Keith, looking back at some of the names that finished behind I Struck a Nerve on the trainer side of things in that Risen Star, Bob Baffert, Todd Pletcher, Dwayne Lucas, what strikes you when you look back and you say, wow, those are all the heavy hitters in the game?
I was thinking of something else when you were asking the question. When you introduced me at the beginning of the program, I didn't get your names. Obviously, you gave me your name yesterday when you called me. But is that Jude Feld in
yeah.
the background?
Yeah, that's him.
Oh, Jude, I didn't realize I was talking to you, man. I would have. I'm already a little crazy, but I might have given you a few more zingers if I would have known you were there.
But you got to elevate your game.
Recognize the laugh. I'm sorry, but you got to go with that question again about Baffert, Zito, et cetera.
Well, no, you're going to have to elevate your game a little bit if you want to.
I'm in trouble.
If you want to get a better soundbite than Kent, you're going to have to elevate your game just a little bit.
Yeah, right. He's a master.
I filled in for Mike Battaglia one day at Keeneland, and I was lucky enough that Kent won the race, and I asked him one question, and he went on for about 5 minutes. And when I got back up to the press box, everybody said, "Oh man, that was a great interview." And I said, "I only asked him one question."
Yeah, made your job easy.
That's right.
Well, like he's got a little more experience than me in front of the mic, so I'm not even going to try to compare.
Well, you're doing a great job today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, Keith, just that question I asked you about Bob Baffert, Todd Pletcher, Dwayne Lucas, they obviously all finished behind you with I Struck a Nerve and The Risen Star. When you look at that, what kind of hits you and goes through your mind when you see all
first
the greats?
First of all, man, I got now I hear the question. And the first thing, dang it, the first thing that comes to mind is the fact, you know, that we won the race. We won a hometown race with hometown connections. Goodness, it's aggravating sometimes, to tell you the truth, when these guys just ship in from Florida, California, wherever it may be, and beat us like it's simple. And this game is not simple. We all know that. But them for them to consistently come in for the Risen Star and the Louisiana Derby and win these races sometimes gets to you a little bit. So For us to do it with a hometown horse, hometown connections was very, very gratifying.
Yeah, and I imagine the guys that were in a sour mood the next morning were Lucas and Pletcher.
Well, you know, speaking of sour, I think the excuse they gave or Code West gave for getting beat is that he didn't see my horse on the outside. Well, what I have to say to them is the only reason my horse didn't draw away from his horse at the end is because he didn't see my I've Struck a Nerve didn't see Code West way down there or the inside on the inside, or he would have drawn away from him just like he did from the third and fourth place horses. So that's just a sourpuss excuse for getting beat.
There you go. Now you're talking like a Louisiana horse trainer.
There you go.
Louisiana Derby next, I would assume, right, Keith?
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, that's a no-brainer. It's $1 million. It's in our backyard. It's 5 weeks out from the Kentucky Derby, and it's just perfect timing. So, yeah, no-brainer. That's where we're going next.
And I can imagine for a guy from Louisiana, that would be special to win the Louisiana Derby.
Absolutely.
Keith, we appreciate you being here with us tonight. Hard to believe it's been 25 minutes already, but great stuff, my friend. All the best with I've Struck a Nerve. We're going to look forward to catching up with you up the road again, but thank you for being here and had a lot of fun.
All right, same here. Will someone – is this still on, I guess? I don't even know what channel you're on Sirius, man. You got it. Someone has to call me and let me know.
We'll do that. We'll give you a call.
All right, thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Keith. All right, Keith DeSormo, the trainer of I've Struck a Nerve and the brother of Hall of Famer Kent DeSormo. I knew that was going to be a fun interview.
Yeah. No, he's a really good guy. I really enjoy spending time with him. I was down at Lone Star Park when he was there. I had horses there, and that's when I first got to meet him. And, of course, spent a lot of time with him, with Kent and his family and my family. So, it's funny, he didn't really realize it was me until we were almost done.
Well, don't forget, we are back tomorrow, 3 to 7 Eastern time, with our HRN Live coverage. And, of course, our brand-new call-in show tomorrow night. It will be the Brisnet.com call-in show presented by Twin Spires at 6 to 7 Eastern. Your chance to call in. Going to have some great prizes from Bris as well. So make sure you get ready to dial tomorrow night, 6 to 7 Eastern time.
Yeah, it's going to be a good show. Can't wait.
It'll be fun. Looking forward to it. That'll about do it for us here tonight. Been a lot of fun, and looking forward to that show tomorrow. Our thanks to Jeff Greenhill, Keith DeSormo. For our producer, Lee Delapina, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you tomorrow on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.